Landscape Photography World, the podcast for everyone passionate about landscape photography. I'm Grant Swinburne. I'll be your host on this show, talking to landscape photographers about their motivations, likes and dislikes. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Verity Milligan, an acclaimed professional photographer and content creator based in Birmingham, UK. Renowned for capturing the richness of the natural world, she works both locally and internationally for recognised brands. Her signature lies in revealing the essence of diverse locations, be it Birmingham skyline, the rugged Outer Hebrides, or the serene Lake District. Through masterful use of light and composition, she crafts images that evoke mood and draw viewers into the scene. Having traversed the UK from the Scottish Highlands to the hills of Worcestershire, Verity is driven to capture the UK's natural beauty with a keen eye and a passion for storytelling. She recounts her early experiences in genealogy, cinema and lecturing before turning to photography, initially as a stress outlet and eventually as a full-fledged career. She eloquently describes the allure of being out in nature, capturing images that resonate with her passion for the outdoors. We discuss the combative nature of imposter syndrome and the importance of authenticity, motivation and human connection in photography. Verity also gives insightful thoughts on her experiences with YouTube video production and shares potential challenges facing the future of photography. I hope you enjoy the show. G'day, Verity. Welcome to Landscape Photography World. How are you going?
I'm going good. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure. I've watched quite a few of your videos on YouTube and seen a bit of your work around social media and so forth. And I really want to talk to you about both the photography in particular, but I'm also interested in how you got started in YouTube and all that sort of thing. But we'll get to that a little bit later. Why don't we start with why you got into photography in the first place? How did it happen for you?
I think it was probably a bit of an accident. I was actually writing about this last night that, I was writing about this last night where I think a lot of my career paths appear that I've just meandered into something and gone, oh, this is nice. I quite like it here. So I've been a genealogist and I've been a cinema owner and I've been a lecturer. And then I picked up a camera and I did a lot of video. I taught video at undergrad level. And I picked up a camera, stills camera, probably when I was 25, and just really enjoyed the sort of more instant gratification you get with stills photography, whereas video can be very laborious. And it grew from there. I didn't really intend it to become a career. It became more a stress outlet, something I did for fun, a hobby. I think a lot of photographers start this way. And it grew legs and decided to take its own trajectory, and I went along with it.
Sure. So where did the art start? Where did it become art as opposed to, say, most photographers, and not saying everyone does this, but most photographers start out documenting their world or documenting their day or whatever, and you see all sorts of photography out there, food photography and all the rest of that. But at some point, I think particularly for landscape photographers, there's this trigger point where the brain starts to look at it differently as opposed to just being, here's a nice scene that I saw, click, off we go, on to the next one.
Yeah, photography for me was always about being outside, and I think it very much still is. And I think the image itself or the end product often comes as a result of the release from just being out in nature and the landscape. And I'm not quite sure where the crossover occurred, to be honest. I think I started 2008 on Flickr and posting images. A lot of where the crossover came was more cityscape stuff. So I moved to a city in the UK called Birmingham.
Yep.
And I started sharing a lot of images of Birmingham, mostly because I was trying to make friends with the city. And the best way I knew how was to go out and take my camera and do it that way. Yep. And that's where it started to become more than just me taking photos. It became much more of a methodical practice and something that I was putting time and effort into and was gaining recognition from. The landscape stuff as well. Yeah, I guess the mid-2010s is where I really started taking it very seriously. Not seriously, but this is my profession. More trying to consistently create a quality of work and a body of work, which I'm sure you understand yourself. when you start out, often landscape photography can be single image led. And as you evolve into deeper into the discipline, it becomes much more about trying to create a coherent body of work. Or at least that's what I feel like I've been trying to do, struggling to do at times. But I don't know what your experience of that has been.
It's been very sad. I can pinpoint the exact moment when I started to take it seriously. And I started back in the film days, of course, being as old as I am. But I didn't really do much photography. I got into a career in IT, and that, having children, family, yada, that soaked up most of my energy at the time. And it wasn't really until I was on holidays in one of my favourite places. There's a beach south of Sydney here called Huskisson. It's in a bay. It's spectacular location. Hyams Beach is probably one of the most famous places in that bay. Anyway, it was sitting there looking at a really nice sunrise and going, okay, I'm not really happy with how this is working for me. I need to really change the way that I do it, the way that I do things, the way that I'm capturing, the way that I'm editing, et cetera, et cetera. And that was where something flicked in my brain anyway and said, you probably need to do this differently to the way that you have been. And from there, as you say, it then becomes more around building a body of work. And I'm probably best known for seascapes, a few waterfalls and cityscapes. But the seascapes, that really got me. And it's that body of work around the varying seascapes around Sydney, but also other locations here in Australia. It's just got me hooked. Standing knee deep in water is my happy place.
You're saying that I went traveling in 2011. I had saved up to go around the world on my own. And I took a little, I think it was a Nikon D90 with me and a wide angle lens. I didn't take a tripod and like an 85mm 1.4. Sure. And I went on this little jaunt for 3 or 4 months, came to Australia. And I remember having a dedicated amount of time where there was time every day to just go and take images, and really pushed me along. It really kickstarted that process. Although I'm not a big fan of sticking to one genre, which maybe is a downfall in some ways, is probably, but I love experimenting.
I don't think so. I think variation is actually, if I know that it's going to be cloudy and rainy, I'm going to go and shoot a waterfall or go and shoot a street, because they're the ideal times for that. And they're not the ideal times for doing seascaping, though you can still get moody seascapes. I know. And I do.
But you fall into what you really prefer as well. And that shouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. That if some people would prefer it rainy when they're shooting seascapes, but you have a preference, and I think that should be encouraged. And I think every time you do something different, like you said, doing street photography, I don't do a lot of street photography, but I always find when you do a different genre, it improves the one that is your dominant one. It makes you go back and think about it differently, and getting out of the comfort zone, I think, is an overused phrase, but the idea that you're in one bubble and stepping out into somewhere that feels new and maybe a bit overwhelming, and you feel like you're not at the top of your game. I feel like that's where the learning really happens. And I end up taking that back to some of the more polished stuff that I do. And photography is meant to be fun, first and foremost, right?
Absolutely.
And if you're not having fun with it, then it's probably worth stopping. And I did that with cityscapes for a while. I'd taken so many pictures of Birmingham that I got to a point where I felt like I was just replicating myself. I wasn't really doing anything different. So I just stopped for about 6 months to a year. Stopped. Mm-hmm. And that felt really risky at the time, because a lot of my paid work was coming through people who were seeing my work of Birmingham in particular, and then hiring me to do commercial jobs based off the back of that.
Yeah.
But I think if you keep hammering the same nail, it's inevitably going to bend and break. Yeah. It just felt like I wasn't being true to myself, I suppose the Gen X way of saying it would be like you were selling out for the professional side of things. So having put that down and then walked away from it, I think it gave me the courage to do that with other parts of my photography portfolio. Like if I'm overdoing this thing, then go and do something else, and it's not going to be the end of the world.
Yeah. You're right. You mentioned that going out of your comfort zone and doing stuff, that infers that you're going to go into realms where you might have less experience or you might have less of the skills necessary. And it comes down to some, it might even just be some of the nuanced techniques that you need. Street photography is quite different to sitting there trying to do a seascape. It's quite different to shooting a waterfall, etc. And I'm interested in how you've dealt with experimentation and with trying something new. There's always that possibility of failure, or the lessons, as I prefer to call them, that you get out of not doing it right and going, okay, that didn't work the way I thought it was going to. Mm. What have I got to change and adjust? How have you dealt with those sort of disappointments or failures, whatever you want to call them, or lessons?
If you think about it, like we didn't get anywhere by getting it right first time.
No, there's no joy in it.
No. And I think I can sometimes give myself a hard time by not being on the money every time. But I think the photography, like if I think back to 2008, I keep everything on my Flickr from the early days because it's really useful to go back and think, oh, no, I was terrible. Like this is an awful photo. And clearly I was trying to take out someone's retinas. But all of that kind of experience, it didn't necessarily feel like failing. It felt like progressing. It genuinely felt like progress. But I think sometimes, especially if there's been a reaction to something or some of your work is revered, might be too strong a word, but people respond to it and resonate with it, then I think if you put out work that then by the same standards flops or isn't taken in the same way or doesn't have the same effect, then sometimes it can be a bit demoralizing. But I think it's a really fine balance because my journey, and you said you started when you were in film days, and I feel like there was almost a purity to stuff back then because you were taking the image, developing it, and it was yours and it wasn't anyone else's. You might have shared it with someone, but with digital, there's this kind of impetus to share on social media, this idea that an image isn't necessarily an image until it's had a public response to it. And there's a really fine balance between letting that almost interfere with the creative process. And I think I really struggle with that sometimes, that when I think this isn't going to do well.
Yeah.
But this iPhone shot of the sunset will go through the roof. And it's sometimes quite hard to maintain some kind of personal integrity, I guess. I think, but failing is good. I think failing is really good. And I think what's important isn't to not let it, and this is coming from a personal stance, knock me off the course that I am on, to allow it to fail. And failure doesn't mean that something isn't good. I think it's taken me a really long time to learn that. Well, if I think in a social media sense, that failing doesn't mean that the image isn't worthy. It just means that the algorithm wasn't on my side that day.
Yeah.
But I think it's worth looking back as well. I think sometimes you can't tell that progress unless you do a sort of retrospective and look back and go, oh, no, I can see where the little seed of this started and where it faltered and where it wasn't quite on point. And now I see that all of that many months of working on something has finally come into fruition. And I love failing. I will never get anywhere without messing up. And
I think failure is a integral part of learning. If you're not failing, you're probably not learning. simply because it is, it's the cliche of riding a bike or learning to drive a car. Everyone starts off consciously incompetent. And where you want to get to is being subconsciously competent, where you don't even think about the process anymore in so many ways. I know what settings I've got to put my camera in. I know where I want to put my camera. It's the nuances then of, okay, how high I'm placing the tripod or placing the lens, or am I going to tilt it down and put less sky in, and or tilt it up and put more sky in? All of those, they're the things that actually end up making the difference, not the technical competence that you end up with. But you don't get to that subconscious competence without making mistakes from where you start, which is consciously incompetent. You don't know what you're doing, really. Nobody, okay, it's a little bit different now with iPhones and the like, where, okay, all you got to do is open the phone app and push a button.
But yeah, but that feels almost, yeah, a different, that I do think there's a delineation, isn't there? Like the crafting versus the moment, in a way.
Absolutely.
And the way they have to work together.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it's learning that craft side and so forth, and making mistakes in that along the way of, I didn't nail that composition, I didn't nail the focus, or whatever it is that I didn't get quite right, that makes me, anyway, want to go back and try it again somewhere.
It's play, isn't it? I mean, if you think about how we learn as kids, it's your place to be fun. And I think maybe as we get, I don't know, I mean, maybe it's just a generational thing, or the where we are in society at the minute, but there's quite a lot of people, the notion of picking something up and being good at it immediately, that just isn't going to happen. Well, they say that maybe this might be a completely pointless stat, but I think they say 10,000 hours to get really, really good at something. And I think the idea of putting time in can be quite frightening, thinking, oh, but that's where it has to be fun. It has to be enjoyable. And I think, yeah, I really enjoy picking up new disciplines. Flexing those creative muscles that may have just got forgotten somewhere along the line. And I'm a big proponent of switching and changing and playing around and seeing what happens and enjoying that process and then putting it down for a year and doing something else.
So do you have a process for, say, setting creative challenges for yourself, or is it more you do it by feel?
I think I'm very intuitive and probably not the best planner. So a year ago, I spent the whole of February on a Scottish island called Harris, which is in the Outer Hebrides. And I planned that for a couple of years beforehand with the idea of just having a month in a place that I find very creatively inspiring, and to almost get in rhythm with the weather. And February in Scotland is wild. There's passing storms, there's always the threat of snow. And I think with stuff like that, was really nice to have a planner to take that time out, because otherwise I find it's very easy for my creative work to get swallowed by the commercial impetus. And especially coming out of COVID, it's only really been in the last year that my freelance career has got back to where it probably should have been in 2020. And I think because of that experience, I've been placing more emphasis on just taking jobs that come up and not necessarily being mindful about giving myself time to do creative stuff. So last February, it was really nice just to have this month of there is no responsibility. There is nobody pulling on my time. I can get up for every sunrise. I can go out for every sunset. I can just immerse myself in this landscape. And I think that's probably one of the first times I've allowed myself to properly do that. And other than it passing far too quickly, it was just wonderful to push myself to do different things. There was days when the light wasn't good, so it leaned more towards abstract. There were days when the light was amazing and everywhere you pointed the camera was just a photo opportunity. But I think allowing myself to have that chunk of time probably helped me grow again as a creative and fall back in love with the medium as well. I think because I am a commercial photographer, sometimes it all gets mixed up. So separating it out again and saying, this is why I love this and this is what pays the mortgage, is, you know, they can be two very separate things. And sometimes just it's really good to put one down and pick one back up again without the other interfering.
I normally ask about that. How do you get that balance between the pulls that you get on the commercial side of things, because a client wants what a client wants? How do you infuse your own creativity into that work? And how do you, it sounds like you see quite a separate delineation between that work and your own personal work.
Yeah, because landscape photography, unless delving into tuition or workshops, landscape photography isn't commercial. You know, yeah, absolutely. So a lot of the stuff I do commercially is adjacent, and the adjacent stuff is the stuff I really enjoy. So architecture, I work with architects to capture buildings inside and out. Love those jobs. I've never met anyone more finickety than architects. They all come back to me with a red line because like a building is 1 degree out, and those make me a better photographer. They make me a much more competent photographer in my own process. But we were talking about comfort zones. I get asked to do headshots with unnatural lighting, so it's really quite a jarring. I could be out photographing the Lake District one day, and the next day I'm doing 50 headshots for a corporate organization, and that juxtaposition is sometimes but I think it makes, again, comfort zones, it makes me a better photographer to get out of that, but it can sometimes swallow my whole life. It's feast and famine when you're a freelancer. So you have, winter is generally quite quiet commercially, but summer's ridiculous. So my time ebbs and flows about how much I've got. And I think the balance is quite difficult to get right. And I haven't got it right yet. I didn't really get to do much of my own work from about June to December last year. And that's the whole point of me going freelance, was I had time to go and do the things I wanted to do and take the photos I wanted to take and really grow into that. But if it just ends up like the job I had before, like it probably isn't worth it. So yeah, there is a balance to be found there. And of course, I'm really grateful that I make a living. This is the dream, right? That if you're a photographer, you're getting paid by people to take photos. But what a client wants and what I would go out and take is usually quite far apart. As an example, I had one client, this was a couple of years ago now, I think it was pre-pandemic. They'd seen my Lake District work, and which is often misty. And it was middle of summer, it was July, and they were like, we love this image. And they picked out an image that I'd taken in November, autumn mist. And they're like, we want to recreate this. We've got a 2-day shoot. Do you think you can do that? I was like, I can certainly go and get you some landscape images, but I can't recreate a season when it's not that season. So we went and did it, and it rained.
Where's the fog going to come from?
Yeah. It was wet. It was miserable. We got a little bit of light eventually. But of course, there was a gap, like a disappointment that I could not replicate something that was virtually impossible to replicate.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I've had jobs. I did an ad campaign for Yorkshire Tea, and they were brilliant. They were like, go up to Yorkshire, have 3 days recceing.
Nice.
You've got 3 days to shoot the scene that we choose in every single weather condition, and then one of them will work. And I think it's about trying to find clients that understand and have the budget for, if we're doing landscape photography, just how fickle the weather can be, and to understand that you get what you get.
Yeah,
well, and I manipulate it to a certain extent.
I know exactly what you mean. We occasionally get, or I occasionally have managed to get a bit of travel work, and of course they're building their campaigns for summer in the middle of winter. They want that lovely blue sky summer with lots of people out on the beach in bikinis and umbrellas. And depending on where you are, if it's the south coast of Australia or south coast of New South Wales, then it's not that.
No, and it's really difficult, isn't it? Because
it is,
but like commercial work tends to, it's now, they need it now, they're not thinking a year and ahead. It's tricky. And I think a lot of that is about confidence and being able to assert and set an expectation, which I don't think is a natural position for me to be in. I think I'm getting much better as I get older, but being able to stand my ground and be like, this isn't possible. I can give you this, but I can't give you that. Benefits both the client and me in the end. But having the ability to say, this is the expectation. Your expectation's here. Mine's a little bit down here, but I'll get you something that will work in one way or another. So
And
yeah,
it's, I think you're right. It's about finding those clients that are flexible and understand that when they ask might not be the ideal time for capturing what they want.
yeah. I, some of my favorite commercial jobs have been completely irrelevant in terms of landscape stuff. Did an annual report for a housing developer, which was working with models for 8 days, and that was amazing. That was really good fun. Completely different from what I'd done usually, but it was given time. We were given really clear briefs. The client was on site. It was just, I love that. I love that collaboration. And oddly, I think it's what it's missing from, or hoping to rectify this year, is missing from my work, is spending more time with other photographers. And you were saying in our brief conversation before we began, the more you talk to other photographers, the more it can inspire your own work. And we're perhaps a little bit siloed off. Or maybe it's just me that's siloed myself off a little bit. But building those friendships and relationships, I think, is only ever going to be a good thing.
Yeah,
So
absolutely.
yeah, more collaborations, more working with people, whether it's commercial or on a personal level.
I'm also interested in the communication aspect of photography. Photography is very much a visual communications medium. What many photographers talk about storytelling in their photography and so forth. Is that something you aim for? Or what are you trying to communicate with your photography?
My personal photography, probably little moments of magic. I think I forget that lots of people don't get up for sunrise. Lots of people don't have the, they don't want to trudge out into the middle of nowhere and stand there for an hour pre-dawn and get significantly colder than they were before to witness a minute or so of light. But those moments feel transcendent to me. They are a little bit of the glue that kind of binds it all together, these universal moments of beauty. And I think, in a way, I hope that I'm a bit of just the conduit for that. It can go through me and through my camera, and hopefully then that brings someone else a little bit of joy. I'm not sure I ever really set out with a mission statement or an idea of what I wanted from this. It was always just a beautiful addition to being outside, and being outside is really important for my mental health, to be out in nature, to
Yeah.
experience the quiet. And I think those little moments of magic, they're like the cherry on top of the experience, but that's the bit that conveys it strongest. It's like something that's been capitalized. It's like, this is a I've distilled this whole experience into this one image or this set of images, and just how beautiful this place can be.
Yeah.
And it might just be that simple for me, rather than necessarily wanting to, I don't know, head towards a place. For me, it's really simply just about being outside and then sharing that experience.
What does
What
success?
about
Oh, for
you?
me, yeah, I have thought about this quite a bit. I try to convey those moments, as you said, because like yourself, I do tend to get up for sunrise more often than not. I don't shoot a lot of sunsets, and it's not because I live on the East Coast, so it's natural to go for sunrises than sunsets. Still see some spectacular ones, but usually from my backyard, which isn't that photogenic.
Same.
But for me, it's about expressing that moment in that space and trying to convey the feeling of standing knee deep in water if I'm at a, whether it could be that at a waterfall too. But it's that feeling that I guess of that moment in time in that space and getting conveying that to somebody. I felt like I had an inkling of that yesterday, actually. I posted an image and somebody came back and gave it this really wonderful description, which I would never have thought of. I'm fairly straight down the line. Here's a shot. And I don't say too much about it, but they were talking about mango coloured chiffon and all the rest of this sort of thing. And I was going, wow, that's good. I love it. I might steal it. But it said to me that person obviously connected with it and they felt something similar and akin to what I was feeling at the time because
it was quite a dreamy sort of sunrise image with a wave splashing over a rock and a bit of water flow in the foreground. And pardon me, for me, the success in getting somebody to comment back, that's what they felt about it, is really where I went, yeah, okay, well, I might have nailed that one.
It's funny, isn't it? Like, there is, photography is pretty ubiquitous now, and there's so much imagery out there, and it feels really nice when an image cuts through and obviously inspired someone and they connected to it. That for me, like when people ask or buy my prints and then they send me a picture of them on the wall, it's a bit overwhelming. It's a bit like, oh, I created something that someone else wants to look at on the daily. Wow, that's not what I expected from this. And it always feels exciting and like a privilege. And you know, when you're out and everything seems to come together, and I don't think this happens with every image. I think some images, you have to drag them out of the camera, but you get, I call it a trifecta. So you have, your conditions are great, your composition is on point, and then the content of the image as well. So whatever you're taking a photo of, and I love it when those three things come together, and it's, you would never be able to replicate it again. And it happens, and it's captured, and it's embedded in the SD card. And I love that. I love that you get to take this explosion of a moment that will never come again and then put it out there and share it with the world. And that might sound really dreamy, but I suppose that's the thing that keeps me going, that sort of that really visceral connection to a moment.
You mentioned something about where I started with film photography and what you were just saying, that sharing is a part of it. But back in the day, you stuck your photos in a photo album and you drag them out when you felt like it, or if friends had come around and they wanted to see the baby or whatever it was that you got photos of in the album. The thing I think that has probably changed in terms of social media is that now you're sharing it well beyond family and friends. It's anyone in the world just about, which I think is a fantastic thing. But I also come back to a lot of my photography. There's loads of stuff that I don't post, and I usually only post one shot a day, and that might extend to 4 or 5, maybe 6 or 8 shots out of a shoot when I go out for a morning. But a lot of stuff also goes into photo books that I produce for myself, and I don't try to sell them or anything. They're intermixed with shots from the phone and family shots and whatever. It's about the memory. That's what those books are for. And for me, seeing them in print is actually where I go, wow, that's really where that image belongs. Is that the same for you, or do you feel different? You're probably a slightly different generation than I am, but...
Yeah, I'm far too millennial to print stuff out.
I'm interested. Do people print stuff out much anymore? You know, the photo book sites, they're everywhere. They're always advertising, but I'm just interested in what other people do.
Oddly, I don't know. I could probably name a handful of people from my friendship groups. I'm at the top end of the millennial generation, but a lot of the people I hang around with are probably further into it. Yeah, there's not much emphasis on, and I think it's actually quite a loss in a way, because I think you're right, seeing something printed and in physical form is almost the logical end of a photograph's journey. And I think a lot of the time we just don't get to that point. I've done exhibitions, so I very much enjoyed seeing my work printed that way. I published a book years ago with Pozo Books, who did like these little landscape editions, and that was fun as well. But I can't say that I personally print off my images. I think, yeah, I suppose I have the same response. So if I look at like my phone, I'll say, on this day a year ago, the image is the memory. It's the way of unlocking. So my partner, she resolutely writes a journal every night, and I've never been able to do that. I've tried and failed, and I'm in my early 40s now. Forget it. It's never going to happen. But for me, like the images themselves, whether it's the phone shot I took to before I got my camera out, they become like a visual journal. They become a way of
Sure.
connecting back to that memory. And yeah, I've never really, my sister-in-law, she does photo books. She's a little bit younger than me. So she's, there are people out there that still put all of their images and get them printed out. But yeah, it's not something I've really dabbled in. I would like to put out another book at some point, but the first book I put out, I felt like I didn't have enough coherency. So I wanted it to be much more on a theme rather than just freeze.
Here's my top 40 or 50 shots or whatever. Yeah,
yeah, something a bit more. Yeah. So I'm working on a project at the minute called Another World, which is not revolutionary, but it's literally just sort of coastal scenes, really almost abstract coastal scenes from the northeast of the UK. And for me, that's new. I'm working on a project that will take time, and a lot of the images probably won't be shared online. And then I'm hoping to put that out as some form of media, and whether it's a zine or something, but have it as a curated body of work, because I do think it is a step in the evolution of a photographer, like to go down that path and be a bit more conscious of the work that's being produced and how it's sitting together as well. I admire people who put books out there. I really do. I admire people who put them out on the regular, because that's so much work and so much effort. And yeah, they are. They've got maybe more energy than me. I'm not sure.
I'm interested in how people pull their projects together. You mentioned that one that you were just talking about. How do you work on your projects? Do you have half a dozen running at one time? I was talking to, I think it was Jennifer Renwick, actually, a little while ago, a few episodes ago, and she was saying that she has about 50 on the go at the time, which that would blow my tiny little brain. How do you work with projects?
I've always got ideas. I think my brain is neurodiverse, and so there's 100 different things going on at once. So, yeah, I've always got at least 10 things on the go. The problem is not all of them come into fruition, so it just depends what wins out in any given moment. I am not naturally predisposed to being organised. And I think a lot of people who work on projects really well are much more kind of able to have a singular focus, whereas my brain is a scattergun of, what shall we do today? It's fine. It can sometimes be infuriating, but I think sometimes because of that kind of noise in my head, that going out and taking a single image tends to end up being the thing I revert to. Oh, I'm just going to go take an image. I'm not necessarily thinking about the whole. Taking the opportunity to slow down and think about projects is a new development.
Fair enough. Talk to me about YouTube. Where did that start and how did you...
I don't have a YouTube channel yet. I haven't put any videos out yet. So maybe you've seen me on other people's channels. I've done stuff with First Man Photography, Adam. He's great. And yeah, he's interviewed me a couple of times, or we've just interacted, and that's been really nice to get to know him and go through the process of watching him film a YouTube video has given me... So my first YouTube video is currently in the editing stage. And you were saying, I think before we hit record, that Kim Grant was talking about confidence and how YouTube has given her confidence. I felt like I needed to build up my confidence before beginning that, because it really opens up. It makes me the focus, and that's quite a difficult... It has been quite a difficult concept for me to get my head around, but suddenly I might be the focus rather than the photography. Which, of course, leaves me open to criticism or whatever. And I had to build my confidence up, and it's taken me a long time. But watching Adam shoot, First Man Photography shoot, his YouTube videos, watching, it doesn't have to be that complicated. I've been overcomplicating the whole process. And I think in the age of AI, the journey is going to become so important. And I really enjoyed, like, I filmed it up in Northumberland in the UK in January. And I just got really excited for the first time in a long time about it made me want to get up and go outside, and like the idea of sharing this and someone learning from it. And yeah, and just putting that out there and being creative in the whole process, from filming to editing to releasing. I'd made such a big deal out of it, and it wasn't that big a deal. And now it's almost edited, and I'm like, oh, I'm excited to make the next one. And this might not do anything. This might just die. This might just never get watched on YouTube, but that's okay. And it's the creative process of making it that's been fun. So that's the reward in itself. And yeah, so it's taking me way too long. I've been doing this for 10 years. I should have started the YouTube channel years ago, but it's confidence is a tricky beast. And if it's not quite there, you can't force it. So I had to do the work to get myself into the place where I was comfortable being in front of camera.
Yeah.
And I'm finally there.
That confidence and pushing back against the imposter syndrome that everybody sort of suffers with, that little voice in the back of your head that tells you either your work or yourself or whatever is not worth it. How do you deal with that? Everyone has that feeling, as far as I'm aware, I think, except unless you're a psychopath.
Can confirm. Not a psychopath.
I'm certainly not, because I get that. But I'm interested in how you deal with that. How do you deal with the little niggling voice in the back of your head that says, nah, this isn't any good, when in reality, it's probably more than good enough?
I think it depends. Sometimes I can deal with it, but sometimes I'll just have to accept that it's not my day. So sometimes, and I'm being really honest and suppose vulnerable in a sense here, that if I post something sometimes and it does nothing, and it doesn't seem to cut through, and sometimes I'll just have to delete it and walk away from it and be like, okay, it's not worth the stress. You don't need this to take over the mental space in your brain right now. You don't have to worry about social media. Just step away from it. Mm-hmm. And I think imposter syndrome is really, it's better than it used to be. And I've realized for a long time, I was asking permission to be a photographer. Like I was maybe just seeking permission. Like we talked about YouTube just now, like I didn't feel like there was room or it was valid or people would have wanted that. And there's an idea of just seeking permission, and actually the only permission I need is myself from myself. Yeah. So I think sometimes I deal with imposter syndrome fine and I'm able to just accept and push through. But sometimes it can be really hard, and those times you just have to look after yourself. And understand as well that everyone is feeling the same. I think that's been a bit of a revelation over the years.
Yeah, I think a lot of people think they're the only person that thinks that way. But I know through what now 138 interviews with photographers, large and small, in terms of their audience, and many of those big names that you see on YouTube or on social media with large followings and whatever, they suffer exactly the same feeling. Despite the fact that much of their work is incredible now, wasn't always incredible. And I think the thing to remember for a lot of people is everyone's at their stage in the journey that they're going on. Nobody's necessarily at the end where they go, okay, all done. I've created the perfect
photo.
I've
completed it, mate.
Yeah, I've nailed it. I've nailed photography. I've nailed social media.
Oh, gosh. Can you imagine? I always think if someone thinks they're at the top of their game or there's no learning to be done, then it's time for them to walk away.
Oh, absolutely. It's like trying to finish Netflix or YouTube. You never will.
It's all relative. It's like you were saying, it's all relative, because I found that insecurity exists whether you have 150 followers on Instagram or whether you have a million. That the same insecurity exists. It's almost universal. And you're right, I think if someone doesn't have it, I'd be highly suspicious of them. Okay.
Walk away.
Are you? Yeah, absolutely. Are you a robot? But I think it makes us human. I mean, that human condition of being afraid is maybe too strong a term, but having an internal dialogue about worthiness and still pushing through and still sharing, that is so wonderfully human. And I love it. Like when I see people that I know struggle putting work out that is different, that is brave, that they isn't just a sunrise or a sunset, is thoughtful, is working out of their comfort zone. My instinct is just try and lift them up, to try and give them as much support as I can, because if you can make someone's day, like the person who commented on your photo about the colors and how they responded to you, that just, I feel like it heals a little bit of that imposter syndrome. You think, okay, no, this is worth it. This has got a point. This has got a reason. I'm doing something that is worthwhile. That might be me being a bit grandiose.
No, I don't think so. Do you think that self-criticism is an important part of growth?
Potentially. I think also,
I mean,
a little bit of competitiveness.
To the point where it's crippling.
Yeah, and I think, and it can quite easily get to that point, I think, if you allow it to fester. But I think there's something to be said about feeling competitive as well. Not to the point of destruction.
Sure.
But I think if you see work, it doesn't happen a huge amount, but sometimes I see a photo and I think, oh, God, I wish I took that. I would have loved to have taken that.
I wish I could take photos like that.
I like that little jealousy rises up, that sort of very human reaction to, oh, I wish I could have done that. I'm sad that I haven't created this. I think, again, not in huge doses, but I think it can be really helpful as a motivator. The only way you're going to get that good is where you get out there and you fail and you mess up and you try and you come back and you get better. And then one day you might be that good, but it's not going to happen by sitting here looking at the screen and going, oh, wish I could take that. So I think there's merit in that too. There's merit in the being motivated by other people's success.
Definitely.
Celebrating it as well. Absolutely celebrating it. Like, there's an image by Sophie Carr of, I think she got snowed in Iceland, and it's this wonderful black and white image that she posted a couple of days ago. And I sat and looked at that image for 10 minutes. I want that on my wall. I want to buy that print. It is so good and so inspiring that I want to look at it every day.
Yeah.
And elevate that image. I want everyone to see this image because it's so flipping good. Like, it's just a masterclass.
I know exactly what one you're talking about. And she,
yes.
The last week, I think she's actually posted about 12 images of these snowy windows and snowy cabins in Iceland. And I know exactly which one you mean.
Oh, it's magic is what it is. And magic is what it's all about. And, oh, my gosh, I love that. I love it when I open social media and think there's a photo again. And they're all catalogued in my head, the images that I wish I took. Like, and I can see them all, and they're all there just as as an index file of inspiration that I take with me everywhere.
Speaking of inspiration, I'm interested in, and I almost always ask this question, about how where you live has shaped how you shoot. It obviously shapes what you shoot, because if you've got a beach on your front doorstep, you're going to shoot the beach. You got a waterfall on you in your backyard, you're going to shoot the waterfall. But I'm interested in how it's shaped how you shoot.
Yeah, so I live in the second biggest city in the UK, on the outskirts, in a suburb, it's very nondescript, in a ex-council house that we were able to buy because it was cheap first-time housing. And I'm extremely grateful to be on the housing ladder, because in the UK, and I imagine the same in Australia, and I won't get into the social political, but it's difficult. And I'm not from here. I think that living here for the past 12 years has shaped my photography quite dramatically, because a lot of it was cityscapes. And Birmingham, I don't know how much you know about Birmingham, but it's the architecture, it's much maligned. Like, lots of people will talk it down. And oddly, I became, without really intending to, a bit of a mascot for a reimagining of the city. That just going out and trying to photograph it in the same way I would photograph a landscape, with the light and sunrise and trying to find interesting conditions, helped some people see it in a different way. And that was really gratifying. And the great thing about Birmingham, it's about 2 hours from everywhere, or 4 hours from the Lake District. 10 hours from Scotland, but everywhere's 10 hours from Scotland, unless you're in Scotland. And for me, it's a really good jumping off point. But I wouldn't have a career in photography if it wasn't for the people of Birmingham, because they elevated me and supported me, and the people and the businesses hired me. So I think living here has shaped me in ways I could never have imagined when I moved here. And I was so sad to move here, because where I grew up was, it's a very industrial town, but the countryside around it was completely accessible. And I'd get on my bike as a kid, and it sounds idyllic and a little bit romanticized, but just cycle out, and I was in the countryside. And I wasn't a photographer as a kid, but I used to paint watercolors and just loved being outside. And so moving to a big city felt very overwhelming. Mm. And yet, I think sometimes if you just allow it to seep in, allow yourself to open up to something new, then you never know where it's going to take you. And 10 years ago, I wouldn't have had a clue what was going to happen in these past 10 years. So I'm eternally grateful to Birmingham and its people for everything that they've done for me.
Fantastic. Yeah. Is there what a fake off me? I live in Sydney. I'm about an hour from everything in Sydney. I live out in the western suburbs. Around me, and this is why I started the podcast, around me is very suburban. Suburban streetscapes don't do it for me. I know there's photographers that do wonderful things in shopping centre car parks and all the rest of that sort of thing. That's not me. I've definitely been shaped by my experiences at the beach. There's a series of ocean-fed swimming pools along the coast of Sydney. I think there's about 45 of them or something along the beaches.
Seen images of these. They're great, aren't they?
Yeah, every beach has one. And so you get different conditions and different tides and different sunrise conditions and everything. And just going out there and experiencing those, particularly in summer, jump in the car at 4 a.m, drive out, take shots till about 6, pack everything back in the car, go for a swim, go for breakfast. And
nice. You know,
so it really has shaped that seascaping. I'm not far from the Blue Mountains, so there's lots of bushland, waterfalls, some amazing scenery up there, massive sandstone escarpments and all the rest of that. So it's a nice place to be, and I'm not that far. My wife and I just bought a motorhome. We spent a couple of months up in Queensland going to places we hadn't been, and we're actually setting off next week to down to the Snowy Mountains and the South Coast. That's, I think, going to shape things even more, being more mobile in terms of being able to just park up, spend as much time or as little time at a place as I want, giving me the opportunity to experience different conditions in a location, as opposed to, I'm here on holidays and I've got 3 days, and if I miss the
that's it. It's freedom, isn't it? It's freedom. Having the motorhome is the absolute freedom.
Yeah, it makes a huge difference. The experience up in Queensland, we went to places that ordinarily on a holiday we probably wouldn't have gone, and because it's not that every day's a holiday, but it's the ability to spend the time there that really makes the difference in terms of what you can shoot and how you shoot it as well, and the times of day that you are likely to get out there and do it. So for me, that's going to really shape things quite differently.
And I imagine just getting up early and photographing and then swimming, I imagine it's made you appreciate or fall in love with that part of Sydney just a little bit more, like that kind of, it becomes that relationship that you reform every time you go out there. I think that's really important, that sense of connection to a space. And I think it comes through in images as well. I think you can see when somewhere and someone is connected and in love with that space.
I think that really does make a difference, certainly to the way that I've shot some places. There's some places that I've had much less experience in that I don't necessarily have as deep a connection, and not necessarily struggle to capture. I've been lucky in sometimes the condition, that trifecta occurs, the conditions, the composition, etc., just line up, and I get lucky on the first time I go, but that's a rare event. What's your most memorable experience in terms of photography?
I've had lots, but I think the one that stands out is probably the first moment where the trifecta happened, which was on, it was November the 2nd, 2015, on the side of Derwent Water in the Lake District in the UK. And the forecast had been really poor, but we'd gotten up early, me and a good friend of mine looked out and it was clear. So we thought, we're going to go down to the lakeside. And when we got there, it was just covered in mist, but not too much. It wasn't a pea super. And the colours of dawn were coming through above. And for 2 to 3 hours, it changed and evolved. And it was, and I overuse the word magic, but it was magical. It was beyond anything I'd ever really experienced before. And we were the only people there. And as the mist kind of dipped down, Derwent Water has these islands in the middle, and this was autumn, a late autumn, and probably one of the best autumns we've had in 10 years. And the autumn color was popping, and the light, it was clouding over, but the light broke through, and it sort of illuminated this island with the mist. And there's the free geese that were flying along, and I got this shot, and it's my favorite shot I've ever taken. I'm not a big fan of my own work, really critical, but this shot encapsulates that moment so perfectly that I just. And that was the moment for me. It's when, without being too cheesy, it all clicked. And I was like, this is life. This is the most exciting morning I've had in a very long time. This is what I want to do and experience. And I think every kind of morning since, in some sense, has been trying to live up to that morning. But it was the gateway drug into sunrise, for sure. I love. Like you, I don't do a lot of sunsets, but because I think the morning for me, less about location, but the morning is so quiet and still. And I love that. I love how that feels. The world feels like mine just for a couple of minutes before everything wakes up. And it's very grounding. So yeah, I think for me, that's probably the most memorable moment. I've got lots of ridiculous failures. There was one morning in Birmingham where I think I was taking a picture in this along the canal, and like all of my filters fell off into the canal. And then later in the day, I like leant on my bag and I broke another filter. And then I think finally I dropped a third filter. So I literally went through £600 worth of Lee filters in approximately 3 hours. And I cannot tell you how, like I drove my car home at about 5 miles an hour because like I'm cursed today. I am cursed. So I've had moments like stick in my memory that are far less inspirational, but no less memorable. But yeah,
We all have our bad days. We all have our bad days.
I think you need them sometimes.
I've drowned my camera twice and had new innards replaced twice because I've stood in the wrong place, basically.
This is it. I've got like a Canon R5, and one of their RF lenses is this amazing 28 to 70 constant f2, and I love it. And I love it for commercial work, and I love my personal work, but I like dropped it. It fell off my camera and bounced, and I was like, "Well, there goes £3,000." Thankfully, Canon were able to fix it, but I did my tax return in a rage because I was like, "I need to buy a new lens, so I need to know how much money the government wants from me." And but yeah, that kind of it's par for the course. We break stuff.
Yeah, I'm sitting here looking at a broken 24 to 70 that from a tripod topple, and it landed face forward, and it now doesn't work.
What can you do? It's you get well insured, or you just accept that at some point.
That's it. You insure your gear and you just say, all right, well, I'm gonna have to wait until I can buy another one.
Easy come, easy go. I think that's the point of it.
Absolutely.
But
So have you ever hit a creative wall? Have you ever got to a point where it's just all too much. I can't do it. I don't know what to do with it. And if so, how did you get around it?
I think I regularly hit creative walls. I think they are necessary. And I think if you want it enough, or it's important enough, you'll find a way to climb over the wall. But I don't think there's any sense in bashing your head off it in the hope that the same thing that you've been doing will somehow dissolve it. I think it involves quiet time and reflection and maybe putting the camera down. I think the most, I'm trying to think, the most powerful one, my dad died early 2020, and he'd been such a not necessarily an inspiration, but we often took trips together to the east coast of the UK for sunrise. And I think after he died, I just couldn't pick my camera up. And I know that's probably slightly different to a creative wall, but it felt, and I think we have these moments in our life that delineate between the then and what comes after. Yeah. And I couldn't even open my laptop. It was like, it was the universe saying, now isn't the time. Now is the time to just allow it to settle. And I suppose I love photography so much that it was never going to be a permanent situation. But it really helped me to just get, because I think sometimes the camera, and I've probably said this before in various ways over various mediums, like the camera can get in the way. Sure. And I didn't want the camera to be in the way. So I took, and it coincided with COVID, and I just walked a lot. I went for long, long walks with my phone. And the things I found and the rhythms I got into brought me back to photography eventually. I was always taking photos, but it was for 6 months, it wasn't as defined. It wasn't as purposeful. Yeah. It was reflections on the canal that I snapped on my phone, or a moody sky, or because I was out every day in the same streets and the same suburb, watching the spring turn to summer and feel connected in some way that I hadn't been before. Like I felt like I just needed to, in a way. So for me, when COVID happened, it was almost a relief that my anxiety was low for a time, because all the expectation got taken off me. Yeah. And I could just exist in these long walks. My poor dog, she lost so much weight. She was marched along canals for hours at a time. But yeah, and it brought me a peace that allowed me to come back to photography, maybe with less baggage than I had before. But yeah, and I think I hit creative walls all the time. And I think I do the same thing now. I put the camera away and I go out and I walk with my phone and the dog and I just live and breathe and settle and hope that eventually I'll climb over the wall.
I like what you said about it being a necessary part. You know, I actually just took a month off most of January. I think I went out. And so for me, it was, well, it wasn't anything in particular. It just wasn't feeling it. And I just really didn't help the middle of summer, getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to get out for sunrise is not my favorite thing either. But yeah, I think that it is a necessary part of the experience of photography, getting to the point where, okay, I'm sick of this for a bit. I'm going to put the camera down and do something different.
Yeah, and I think that if you ignore that, I think that can be devastating for creativity. Yeah. If you ignore, like for you now, I imagine that when you go on your trip in a week's time, there'll be a renewed sense of excitement. Absolutely. You know, there's almost starting a conversation up with an old friend. It's all still there. You just gave it time to settle. And I think you can tell. Like I'm for me, I don't know if it's an intuitive thing, maybe I'm imagining it, but I can tell when someone has a real, the difference between having, really enjoying your process and connecting with a space and pumping out content for the sake of it.
Yep.
I think there's an obvious difference between the two, and I'd rather do good work and less work, constantly feed the machine, as it were.
Speaking of feeding the machine, what do you think is the future of photography, and what do you see as its biggest challenge facing it right now?
I think it has a future. I think that as a method of expression, it's important as a way of conveying the stuff that we do, the way to remind people that there is beauty in the world, that it is, it isn't all so bad necessarily. I think it will play a role in trying to preserve the world, in the sense that promoting the beauty that we see will hopefully encourage people to want to be a bit more mindful about how we look after our own space. I think AI is tricky. I don't think it will consume in quite the way that people fear, mostly because it's so energy heavy. But partly because that sense that we just spoke about of authenticity, I think, is more important than people realize. Like, I think, I don't know about you, but I can tell an AI image a mile off.
Most cases, yeah. There's a few that have gone, it could be, but yeah.
Yeah. And it's soulless, is what it is. And I don't think photography has heart and it has soul. And I think that you're never going to get away from that. Sure, replicate a random landscape in AI, but there's no connection there. It's free floating in space. It doesn't mean anything. Whereas something that you've taken or anybody has taken that they've gone maybe 100 times to that location, they've connected with it. They are communicating that connection. They're not just showing you something beautiful. They're communicating that connection and how, and they are in that photo in some way. But I think the journey will become more important. I think showing your working and taking people along on that journey, whether it's TikTok or YouTube or whatever the heck comes next, that is, if you want to build an audience and you want to stay in the game, I think that will become increasingly more important. Not the right word, but part of this experience.
Sure.
And that should be a fun thing. That should be cool. That should be like exciting in a way that it doesn't have to be complicated, but I think people are, they want to come with you. They don't want to just see the final product. They want to enjoy that experience too in some way. And that will fend off any, I like to hope anyway. I'm an optimist, as you can tell. I think it's all going to be fine. And if it isn't fine, then we'll all move on.
Yeah, I for one welcome our robot overlords.
Absolutely.
What's the best and worst piece of advice anyone's given you?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Can't think of any specific example. I think I don't think anyone's actually said this. I think the best advice would be to be yourself. The worst advice, probably, I don't think anyone, I mean, I so rarely accept advice from anybody. Unless, I suppose the best advice would be, if you take advice, take it from someone you trust. Yeah. And if there's someone you trust to take advice from, also accept criticism from them. I think whatever you do in terms of whether you look for critique, if you look, ensure you trust that person. Ensure that, and I think be sparing with that trust as well. I think if there's people that you admire, try and get to know them. I think the worst advice would be don't. So I think there's a lot of photographers who would discourage people from photographing honeypots or look down on them for going to locations that have been gone to 100 times before or 1,000 times. Or like the UK examples would be Corfe Castle. There's always a photo of Corfe Castle. But I think that's really poor advice, because I think those places are their training wheels, their stabilizers. They've got a magic all of their own anyway. And if you catch them in the right conditions, whether it's misty or an epic sunrise, that's going to build confidence. Learning, who cares if a million people have shot that place before? Everybody has the right to go and take their own image of it and experience it themselves. But the worst advice would be listening to anyone telling you that what you should and shouldn't shoot. Go and shoot Corfe Castle every flipping morning. I saw a photo a couple of years ago. So it was, you always end up seeing something different. It was Corfe Castle, but in the mist, and there was a spider's web in front of it. And I forget, it was a woman photographer, and I've forgotten her name. And all of these droplets of dew. And it was amazing. And I was like, see, you can take an original photo. And if they hadn't gone back to that location or they'd been discouraged from doing that, then they wouldn't have got that image. And just follow your own path.
Exactly. I think that's brilliant advice. I've got a couple more questions for you. One is, are there any photographers that I should be talking to on the podcast?
Yeah. So I'm going to pick up some women photographers that
fantastic
inspire me. So we spoke about Sophie Carr. I don't know if you've had Sophie Carr on.
I have, yep.
Ah, damn. So there we go. She beat me to it. There is a photographer called Wendy Bagnall.
I've heard of Wendy. I've seen some of her work, yep.
Wonderful abstract images. There's also another photographer called Claire Brooks.
Okay.
Who is also does some really nice seascapes, and was on Harris the same time. I was on Harris last year. So she's great. There's a photographer called Tracy Whiteford who, early in my Flickr days, really was really inspirational and someone I know personally now. And she's just completed a tour of Canada and Arizona and gone on this little epic journey across the Canada and the States. Yeah. And have you had, just to divert from a different gender, have you had Bill Ward on?
I haven't yet, no.
I would talk to Bill. He's a wonderful human who I've done various workshops and tours with. He's just, he's got full of stories and I think he'd be a great guest to have on. So those are my, and I don't know if you've managed to get him, but Mark Littlejohn, he's
on my list. I haven't reached out to him yet.
A wonderful human and a big inspiration and probably one of the most authentic people, flash photographers operating in this entire genre, and someone who I always look forward to spending time with. So yeah, those are my current, I've probably forgotten about 12 people, but
it's always an unfair question. There's always going to be people you can't. My last question is probably trying to get to the bottom of one of the most important issues, not only in photography, but society in general. Do you like pineapple on pizza?
No. The only thing I like on pizza is cheese. I am a basic human. Margarita pizza the entire way. Although recently I have been partial to the Domino's cheeseburger pizza, but I have to pick up.
Given that one again.
It's like burger sauce, balls of meat. But I have to pick off all the peppers and onions. I like my pizza uncomplicated.
Okay. That's good to know. It's been wonderful getting to know you much more than I did, Kim. Sorry, Verity. It's been wonderful getting to know you, Verity. Where can people find your work?
I suppose all the usual places. Twitter, I'm under a random old nickname, at Vemsteroo. Don't ask. Instagram, just under my name. There's only one of me in the world, I think. There's only one Verity Milligan, and I'm going to keep it that way. No. So, yeah, if you search my name, you'll find me in all the usual places if you're so inclined. And, yeah, thank you for having me. It's been fun to just have a morning chat, my time. Like, it's rolled out of bed and rolled into the study. Like, okay, let's talk photography.
Nice. Thank you very much for taking the time. You've been very generous, a little bit vulnerable, and I hope you had fun.
Absolutely. Look forward to listening to it.
Fantastic. Thanks again for listening to Landscape Photography World. I hope you enjoyed the show, and please keep listening because I'll be joined by some great guests in upcoming episodes. You can find my work in this podcast at grantswinburnephotography.com. I'm also on Vero, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, Threads, and Facebook. I'm Grant Swinburne. Hope to see you out shooting soon.